Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a book in the tradition of John Steinbeck and William Least Heat Moon. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Philip Caputo decided to traverse the country, partly for the sheer adventure of it, but also to ponder a question. How do we as Americans remain united in the face of unprecedented political divides and diversity? He writes that each morning, Alaskan Inupiat children and Cuban immigrants in Key West all pledge allegiance to the same flag. What binds us together? In the spring of 2011, as Americans continue to toil in the wake of our country's worst economic downturn since the Great Depression, our guest loaded his wife, his two English setters, into a vintage Airstream trailer and began an odyssey of 16,000 miles through 14 states over 4 months, from Key West, Florida, to Dead Horse, Alaska, on the Arctic Ocean. The result is his new book, The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Circle. It's published by Henry Holt. Philip Caputo won the Pulitzer Prize for his coverage of election fraud in Chicago for the Chicago Tribune and has since been the author of many books, including Rumors of War, his best-selling memoir of his service in Vietnam, as well as books of fiction, nonfiction, and memoir. The name of the new book is The Longest Road, and Philip Caputo joins us today by phone. Philip Caputo, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure to be here.
This book, The Longest Road, a lot of people have this idea of traveling the length of the country, perhaps not to the extent that you did, going all the way up from, Key West to the Arctic Circle and back, but certainly a lot of people have this dream. You know, when you think of writers and journalists, you have to think of people like John Steinbeck, Travels with Charlie, which I know you quote in the book. There's another book, Peter Jenkins, Walk Across America, which sort of does the same thing. You know, Steinbeck was worried about the corporatization of America when he took his travels. Jenkins was doing it in the aftermath of Vietnam and Watergate. And this is a similar stressful time. Did that go into your thoughts of doing this book and taking this journey, or was it just mainly a journey?
Well, I would say it was primarily a journey undertaken for the adventure of it and just for the experience to travel from the southernmost point in the continental U.S. to the northernmost point you can reach by road, which is Dead Horse, Alaska, on the shores of the Arctic Ocean. But yes, certainly there were thoughts in my mind about the state of the country at this particular time, with the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression, the two wars that were being fought abroad, and no small amount of political divisiveness domestically. What I wanted to do was I wanted to interview as many Americans from as many walks of life as I came across, to find out what their lives were like at this time. And in some cases, it was just what their lives were like, regardless of the particular conditions of the era in which they're living. And you're right in the sense that, going back to Steinbeck, he had worried about the disappearance of the regional accent, the homogenization of America, but it really hasn't come to pass. It really is a country. It's not only diverse, immensely diverse ethnically and racially, but it's really diverse in the different styles of life that people have.
Yeah, I think you picked that up pretty early in the journey, where you're in Florida, and you're in the panhandle of Florida and Alabama, and you're hearing these regional accents. And I think you and your wife, as you would be having dinner in a diner, you would sort of stop your conversation because you were listening to the conversations around you and hearing that dialect, this difference.
Steinbeck, again, Steinbeck had worried that, that was going to vanish. Well, it certainly hasn't. And fairly early in the journey, when we were in Tennessee, we interviewed people in Tennessee who were living on what's billed as the oldest continuously operating hippie commune in America, now has third-generation residents. It's not really a quote-unquote hippie commune with a lot of people in tie-dyed shirts, smoking dope or something like that. It's really a farming community that bears some resemblance, say, to Amish or Mennonite communities. And it was quite fascinating to talk to a 50-year-old woman who had moved there from Florida and two 18- and 19-year-old boys who had grown up there.
and were going to college, but when you asked them what they were going to do, they said, well, we'll probably come back here.
Yeah, they did. I remarked in the book that it was one of the rare times I've actually met adolescent boys who were happy living with their families.
Well, take us through the mechanics of the journey. I know you traveled about 16,000 miles, took 4 months. You picked up this old 1962 Airstream Globetrotter that you took all around the country. What was your plan going in, other than going from the southernmost point to the northernmost point?
The plan was, in general, was to drive as many two-lane roads as we could, whether they were county roads, state roads, or old-timey federal highways that still retain their blacktop status, you might say. In other words, stay off interstates as much as possible. Originally, I had hoped to follow in its entirety, once we got west of the Mississippi, the route that Lewis and Clark had followed in their westward exploration. There's a whole network of roads and back roads called the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, but there was a lot of flooding in the Mississippi and in the Missouri River watersheds that closed off some of those roads, and so we had to revise the plan and headed straight across Kansas and Nebraska.
Yeah, and you met a whole lot of people, like in Florida. You know, this is 2011 at the time. They're still recovering from the huge recession, and you met people from Florida through the first half of your journey. It's these refugees from Florida were ending up in Tennessee and Alabama and everywhere. Mm-hmm. What was your sense of that?
Well, actually, there were refugees from elsewhere who ended up in Florida, and then refugees from Florida who ended up elsewhere. Down in Key West, we met this, I call them a missionary couple. They were both ordained ministers, not by profession, but they had certificates, whatever you call them, making them ministers in a church. The man, Scott Myers, had been a contractor, and at one time his wife, Janita, had been a nurse, but at any rate, he, as a contractor in West Virginia, he completely lost all of his, he lost his job and lost work. And they ended up selling everything they owned, he said, because he got a divine call to minister to the marginalized and to the people who are addicted to alcohol and drugs. And they, I thought we had made quite a journey. They walked.
Yes,
hike
that's right.
From West Virginia to Florida. And then in Tennessee, we ran into two couples. Again, one of the gentlemen had been a contractor who were from Florida, from Sarasota. And one of the couples was building a whole new life for themselves off the grid up in the hills of Tennessee, while the other couple were friends of theirs and were just visiting. But the contractor was telling me just about how the business in the Sarasota area had gone from building 700 houses, I think it was a month or something like that, to two. And and yet the remarkable thing, it's a thing that I found, that in spite of the economic hard times, that old streak of American grit and optimism was still alive and well, and he was convinced that things were bound to get better eventually, and he wanted to be on the ground floor when they did.
And it was interesting, you know, when you hear of a couple moving off the grid, you sort of think of that apocalyptic sort of thinking. They weren't that way at all. They were just downsizing their life and living simply, and I think that was the same for the couple from West Virginia who moved down to Florida to minister. They really basically shucked a lot of their material possessions. That was a theme you ran into quite a bit in the early part of the book.
Yeah, I didn't come to any conclusions about it because I would have had to have made a study of it. But it did seem as though that sudden financial collapse that occurred in 2008 did at least make some Americans question whether the consumer society and the constant acquisition of more money and more goods and more toys was really the way to lead your life.
My guest today is Philip Caputo. His latest book is titled The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Circle. It's about a 16,000-mile journey from Key West up to the Arctic Ocean at the top of Alaska and back again, and meeting people of all walks in life and all places, just getting to know them. And you ran into some really remarkable people along the road. You went through the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, and you met there, first of all, people suffering from incredible poverty, people who are trying to raise the Lakota people, people who are still suffering some of the evils of poverty as well as drink in the Pine Ridge. But you also met this remarkable guy named Ansel Woodenknife. Tell us about Ansel Woodenknife.
Well, yeah, Ansel was one of the more remarkable people that I did run into. He's about in his mid-50s now, and he was raised on the Rosebud Reservation, which is next door to the Pine Ridge Reservation, in a log cabin without electricity or running water, and one of 12 children. And at the age of about 10, he was plucked off the reservation against his family's wishes through a government program that was seeking to, it claimed to help Indian children assimilate, but in a way it was to almost make them into white people. And he was sent to a foster home in Philadelphia, where he spent about 3 years, but constantly kept running away because he just wanted to get back to among his own people. And eventually he was branded as an incorrigible and sent back to the reservation, and never got past the ninth grade. Tried one thing or another. He was a rodeo rider and some other jobs that he held. But eventually he and his mother and his wife went into business running a cafe that sold their specialty, which is called the Indian Taco. And it's basically a taco made from Indian fry bread, but stuffed with the usual things that you find in the Mexican-style tacos. And this cafe was extremely successful. And then eventually he began to market this taco and other Native American dishes, as well as Native American artifacts, to outlets all over America, like Walmart and Safeway. And in time was elected to the South Dakota Small Business Hall of Fame, and then was appointed by the governor to the state's tourist board, and became enormously, judged enormously in the sense of from what he came from, successful. But at the same time, because of his experiences being taken off the reservation and sent off to that white foster home, he wanted to reconnect with his traditional culture, and he became what the Lakota call a sun dancer. It's a ritual that the Plains tribes have undergone for time immemorial, and basically we would say that he became a Lakota shaman or medicine man, we would say, although that term doesn't really quite describe it accurately. And he was a really thoughtful, serene man, despite all that he had been through. And he had a lot to say about the issues facing the country. And he kind of thought that all Americans should somehow or another retain their American identity, but at the same time retain some connection to whatever culture they had come from. And he said that the U.S. would then become, as he called it, a blanket of color sewn into the shape of the American flag.
Yeah, no, that, that was nicely put. He was a real philosopher.
He was. He was, you might say, a backwoods philosopher. And not the kind of guy that spouts a lot of baloney either. He was very thoughtful.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. He was talking about, I think it was maybe talking to a classroom of white kids, and they were saying, well, we don't have this culture. He goes, oh, yeah, you did. Thousands of years ago, you had Celts, you know, banging on log drums, and you know, it's like you had all this culture.
Yeah,
you just forgot it all.
At a college, and he was, and they were all white kids, and of course, a lot of them might not have been Celts, but.
True. And there was another very interesting person you met, and this was in west of St. Louis, Carol Springer. And this was an old activist. She runs a little horse farm, and I guess it's like a B&B of some sort that has horses in the Merrimack Valley. And you know, she fought City Hall. She fought the federal government and won. An amazing, amazing, strong-willed woman, Carol Springer.
Yeah, she actually, her farm is really I would call it a small cattle ranch. That's the primary business, is raising cattle. But to supplement the income, she runs a little B&B and raises horses, Tennessee walkers mostly. What was remarkable about her is that, I think it goes all the way back to the 70s, the federal government and the Army Corps of Engineers, backed by a lot of local businessmen who saw tourist dollars flowing in, wanted to build these dams on the Merrimack River and some of its tributaries that would have flooded the entire valley and turned it into an artificial lake. And her farm, by the way, has been in her family since the administration of James Madison. As a matter of fact, President Madison gave her great-great-great-grandfather a land grant. And so Carol is the sixth generation. Her son will be the seventh to run that farm. And she was utterly determined to save it. And she and a group that called themselves the Merrimack Valley Irregulars fought the Army Corps of Engineers, the federal government, and these commercial interests for years until I can't remember if it was during Reagan's first administration or his second administration. He finally deauthorized the dam project, and that was the first time in the entire history of the Army Corps of Engineers that a dam project had been deauthorized before construction had begun. And as a result, this beautiful valley and this gorgeous farm of hers were saved from being turned into an artificial lake that would just be filled with bass boats
and water skiers. And the funny thing is that you can float that river and the tourism is there anyway.
it is. We canoed the river and on a weekend, and just around every other bend there were picnickers and people swimming and really enjoying themselves. So they, you can't say that it deprived the area of tourist dollars.
My guest today is Philip Caputo. His latest book is titled The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Circle. He took a 1962 Airstream, his wife, two English setters, on a 16,000-mile journey, visiting with people along the way, asking questions and basically doing a lot of listening as people talked about their lives. And in the summer of 2011, you did hear some interesting stories. I mean, there's stories of real hardship. There are stories of people who are hanging in there and doing well. Others just hanging in. I was struck by, as you were crossing the Midwest and the Great Plains, you know, you referred to the poppers, you know, the Buffalo Commons. And of course, this is an issue in Western Oklahoma. We're worried about our small towns drying up and disappearing. And actually, you found examples of both and found really interesting examples within the examples. There was I think it was Lebanon, Kansas, which is near the geographic center of the 48 states. This is a town that probably in another 20 or 30 years won't be there. Yet you found people who were very saddened by that fact. And then there was another person, I think it was a postmaster, who said, yeah, this town's a little big. I could see it getting smaller. You know, I mean, it's just that rural outlook of wanting to be by themselves.
Yeah, I was stunned by that. Lebanon, Kansas, you know, had over 1,000 people in the mid-1950s, and two solid blocks on both sides of the main street of thriving businesses. And now virtually all but one of those businesses is closed. And the population is down to 200 and change. And, the town clerk, a woman who worked at the bank that was torn down, she was very saddened. But the postmistress, Debbie Whitman, she thought the town was too big. Of course, I just blinked when I said, you think this is too big? And she said, yeah, she wanted to live out in the boondocks. But, you know, as a general impression, I who grew up in the Middle West, I personally was kind of saddened to see these small towns disappearing, mostly due to the corporatization of agriculture and the disappearance of the family farm, so that now for any farmer to be economically competitive, he's got to have lots of expensive machinery and high-tech devices, and probably cultivate anywhere from between 6 and, say, 15,000 acres, whatever it's in, corn, wheat, milo. And I assume they're in Oklahoma. I mean, part of Oklahoma is really part of the Midwest, at least ecologically.
Yes.
And I guess it's probably the same problem.
Yeah. Now, you went on further up around South Dakota. You ran into another small town, Belle Fourche, where, on the other hand, things were going really well.
Yeah, you know, one of the things is that in rural America is that just said the family farm is disappearing. But it's interesting is that the cattle business nevertheless seems, if not thriving, at least it's viable, so that the family ranch still exists. It's probably because it's just too difficult to try to corporatize a cattle ranch, and that town was Belle Fourche, which is the center of the United States after Alaska and Hawaii were admitted to the Union. So the center moved from Kansas to the Dakotas, to the western Dakotas, and that town was thriving. There were about 5,000 people in it, and we came there during the state high school rodeo championships, and it was really bustling and rather uplifting after seeing Lebanon. And, you know, another interesting character, too, that we ran into was on a Montana ranch, was a young lady who I don't think could have been 5 feet tall with the wind. And she was a horse wrangler.
Yeah, at a dude ranch, right.
Yeah, yeah. And she was saying that in her teen years, which, of course, weren't that long ago, she had been a quote-unquote girl gangster in a rough part of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and that she realized that that life was going nowhere, and she eventually acquired a love for horses and started to go to work as a wrangler on this ranch.
And that's another theme in the story about how Americans can continually reinvent themselves. And I think going back to Ansel Woodenknife, he talked about it. He says, we have to adapt. Indians have to adapt. We've had to adapt, you know, our culture within 100 years, you know, of dealing with a whole cultural shift. He says that's one of the things I think that determines success is the ability to continuously adapt.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of it that way until I spoke to Ansel, but and he brought my own ancestors up. My great-grandparents had emigrated to the United States from Italy in 1885, and they were, my great-grandfather was an illiterate minor. I mean, illiterate in Italian, to say nothing of English. And it never occurred to me. I said, What a feat of adaptation that was, especially in those days, to go from where he was to the United States. And and I think that that's true, and it's one of the binding forces of America is that we've attracted people who are willing to make those changes. I know I came to my own, you know, insight is especially when it comes to like the immigration problem that's being so hotly debated. And I saw a lot of that, by the way, in Grand Island, Nebraska, where a lot of immigrants from Latin America and Africa are working in a meatpacking plant. And a lot of people, indigenous Americans, object to this influx of immigrants because they feel as though our culture is being changed, transformed, and not for the better. But that's always been true of this country. Whatever wave of immigrants comes over does change the culture, but America changes them as well.
That's true. It was the Irish. At one point, it was the Irish and Italians, and then it was
Eastern European Jews.
Yes.
I mean, who would have thought? You in 1850, if somebody tells you that one of the most American dishes would be the pizza or the bagel, for example. You know, or that iconic American entertainers would be named Sinatra. you know, nobody said, what are you talking about?
That's right. Well, now, as you went along the journey, you did have a central question you were asking, and it gets back to these other travel books that are trying to understand what America is. And it was about the ties that bind us and whether those were fraying or what was it that kept us together. And you ask a lot of people that, and you got a lot of different answers. What was the best answer you heard?
Well, I'd say I have two best answers. One what came from the woman we were discussing before, Carol Springer, the one from the Merrimack Farm in Missouri. And she said that she thought it was a belief that we have more in common than we have differences. But she added, she said that she wasn't sure that that was really true, but that the important thing is that we believe it is.
The perception, yes.
Yeah, so it's as if the perception becomes the reality, or because we believe it, it does become true. And then there was Erica Sherwood, a woman who is a small businesswoman in Breckenridge, Texas, where actually we ended the journey because we had leased the trailer from Miss Sherwood. And she was asking me what I thought, the question you just asked me, and I turned it around. I said, "Well, what do you think, Erica?" And she said, "What do you think holds the country together?" And she said, "It's hope. Isn't that what it's always been?" And I actually end the book on that note, because it did occur to me that if you go all the way back to the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the arrival of the Pilgrims, it was their hope to find religious freedom from the Church of England, that later on it was the hope of the revolutionaries to gain political freedom from the British Empire, and then the whole westward movement that went on for 150 years or 120 years afterward, the pioneers were always looking to improve their lives, and if not their lives, the lives of their children. And then you finally have the immigrant generations like my great-grandparents and grandparents who were hoping to build better lives for themselves. And that's continued right up through the 20th and 21st centuries, not in a literal sense of moving geographically, although that does occur, but in moving up the so-called generational ladder, that my children will accomplish more than I did, for example. And it's always that hope that glimmers on the figurative or the real horizon that has held the country together. I might add that one of the things that sometimes disturbs me when I read about growing income inequality in America, and I see these powerful political forces and economic forces in Washington and in New York who seem to make decisions that dictate the fates of people across the country, I worry about if that hope can be sustained in the future.
Yeah, oh, very interesting. Well, the name of the book is The Longest Road. Philip Caputo, thanks very much for joining us. I enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure.
Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Philip Caputo speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book is titled The Longest Road, Overland in Search of America from Key West to the Arctic Circle. It's published by Henry Holt. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.